Hello, and thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Samuel Jones.
And I'm Guilherme Rosales. It's Thursday, December 6th at
5:03 p.m.
We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territory of the Haukamalem-speaking Musqueam people.
We're starting today's show with a discussion on the legalities that surround going on strike in BC. Sorry. After the recent postal strike got shut down, BC Ferries began talking about attaining the legal right to strike. But what does that mean? Who can strike and who can't? On today's show, we talk with resident expert and News Collective member, Guilherme, who's in studio with us now, all about the right to strike in BC.
Yeah, you just heard his voice. Both a journalist and an expert.
Yes, both
in
both of
striking.
Those.
Thank you.
And then after that, we're going to turn to coverage of Vancouver City Hall, where council recently voted on Motion 12. It was formerly titled Motion 10. And the actual title itself is called Protecting Tenants from Renovictions and Aggressive Buyouts. It was tabled in mid-November by Cope City Councilor Jean Swanson. And the motion intends to protect renters from demovictions and aggressive buyouts. And so we're going to be talking about the version of the motion that passed because there were a couple amendments made.
All right. And so we're going to get right into the current situation surrounding BC Ferries and the larger question about the right to strike in Canada and the power unions have in general. So as mentioned before, we've got Guilherme Rosales, a student in master's of public policy and global affairs, who's worked for the city of Vancouver for a decade and the public service agency as a forest firefighter for 5 years in British Columbia. So he's been in two different unions. On top of all this, he's a contributor to our show, as was mentioned before. Now, for anyone not in the loop, the union representing BC Ferries is currently going before the Supreme Court, arguing for their right to strike. So, Guy, we have some questions about this. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So can you start with the foundations of BC law here and what sort of precedents have been set in the past when it comes to strikes in the provinces and how the government here in BC tends to handle it?
Okay. So maybe I'll just begin with doing a bit of a brief history. So if we kind of roll back the clock and we go to the Harper era, they tried to install and they successfully, I believe, passed some anti-right to strike legislation, but that was actually stricken by the Supreme Court of Canada in 2015. So under that new ruling, it was codified in our constitution that unions do have the right to strike. And of course, that is part of the collective bargaining mechanism where if a union is not agreeing with an employer on an issue and they're not able to kind of come to the table and agree to something, they have a final mechanism to use, which is, of course, striking. And that occurs through a voting process, a democratic process, where the majority of union members have to agree, yes, we want to strike, we don't like these working conditions, et cetera. So that's kind of a bit of a background on the issue.
All right. So could you explain what the right to strike is? You've sort of laid down the conditions for an organization, for a union that has the right to strike, what they have to do, but what do they have to do to get that right in the first place?
Okay, well, I mean, the right to strike is really what it sounds like. It's this ability that unions have to say, no, we're not going to work, we're going to walk out. And this started, like almost a couple hundred years ago. At least in Vancouver, there was the general workers' strike of 1918, where workers were fed up with working conditions, their wages, and they just decided to collectively walk out, or it's also known as collective action. They just simply said no. And of course, employers were pissed off. And there's a lot of violence that goes around those initial moments of the early 1900s and late 1800s when workers would get together and strike. Yet at a certain point, violence is pointless because nothing's happening. There's no productivity. The employer is suffering. So they have to kind of negotiate and bargain again. So essentially, the right to strike is exactly what it sounds. People who are in a union have a right to strike if they all agree that striking is their last and only option available for them.
Right. So what kind of obstacles to striking have exist? How powerful are the unions in terms of just what sort of things can be thrown in front of them to prevent a strike? And what can they do about it?
A lot of the time, at least with government, municipal, provincial, or even federal, different agencies will do bluff charges, in a sense. They'll essentially tell them, you don't have the right to strike. We can legislate you back to work, which they can try, of course. But then, of course, this will go to a court, and the court will determine, based on previous cases, what occurs. In this instance, we know the Supreme Court has said they have a right to strike. What has occurred in recent decades, of course, is this notion of being an essential service. So firefighters, police, we could even say forest firefighters, maybe post office workers, perhaps, maybe even BC ferry workers. An argument will be made by the employer, the government agency or branch to determine that actually your job is essential for the function of society, for safety reasons. And when they construct these arguments or spin them, this is where that's a real barrier or roadblock to striking.
Well, you know, if I could contribute, I think an argument that might be made is that for islanders, it is one of the most effective ways.
Yeah, the government is making that argument.
Yeah,
like if,
yeah.
if a someone needs to go to a doctor and their doctor's on the island and people can be isolated there, so it is being considered an essential service.
So do you, you know, BC Ferries, the union, has said that, you know, they think they have a very strong argument here. Do you think it's a surefire case for BC Ferries, like they sort of think it is? do they have the law on their side, in your opinion?
I would like to think so, but nothing's surefire. I mean, it really depends on the court case, the proceedings, and how things are kind of portrayed. I mean, I personally don't think it is an essential service compared to, since, for instance, police or paramedics, where like the critical safety of members in society absolutely need these services in order to function. Because you can imagine if the police went on strike completely and they weren't going to respond to anything, perhaps some level of chaos might ensue. People would take advantage of the situation.
So just to reiterate, with the BC ferry workers, they all belong to a union. And in 2015, that union brought to a labor board arbitrator the potential that they would be able to strike. Like they brought this ask to this arbitrator and it was turned down. And now they're petitioning to the Supreme Court. Is that's what's happening?
Yeah, currently that is what's happening. And a lot of the time unions that maybe aren't, because right now BC Ferries is quasi-governmentally owned. It's not fully private. It's not fully under the full jurisdiction of the British Columbian government. So with that in mind, you know, they're not part of maybe a more powerful, larger union like the BCGEU or CUPE, which tends to kind of coalition and network build to put a lot more pressure on government to get things done. In
right,
this scenario, yeah, it's a little trickier because they're going back and forth. They're being claimed as an essential service, and the argument for that idea is, you know, not without some weight.
Mm-hmm. But so they're kind of like TransLink in Vancouver, for example,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. So the government hires basically a company, a private company, to run a government service.
Yeah, they were originally a Crown corporation, just like BC Hydro or TransLink, and now they're
exactly.
Not as much.
Right. So can you talk about, or maybe Sam, you were going to get to this, the differences between striking as a government corporation versus a private company?
Well, yeah, I'm quite curious, Bea, for you to expound upon that.
Okay. So when you're working for government, you're generally unionized. I was working for the City of Vancouver. The local union is QP15. It's a provincial and a national union, the Canadian Union of Public Employees. In this scenario, these types of unions tend to be a lot stronger. There's a lot of members. They're more active for the most part. That strength obviously means a higher wage, better working conditions. And of course, if you don't like something happening on the ground floor, you get a lot of say to change what happens. So you can really upset the organization's vision. In the private sector, for instance, film industry, they have the Teamsters Union. They have to play things a little more sensitively because they're not backed by a very powerful union. And when you think about it, you know, we can look at various franchises like McDonald's and Starbucks where people have tried to organize and become unions, and what happens? They just either fire everyone, they close down, and they move somewhere else. So in the private sector, unionizing can be very risky and precarious, and you don't have a lot of power because at the end of the day, the employer can just close shop and move somewhere else, do the whole thing all over again to keep kind of avoiding collective action. So, I mean, when we're considering those alternatives, yeah, government has that leg up. They have to work with a union. There's this long-standing relationship between union and government, whereas in the private sector, it's generally more cutthroat for the most part.
Right.
So unions in the private sector that do get formed, that, you know, do become successful, do you think, I'm not sure if, you know, you can answer this question, but do you think there's a difference in public perception there? Do you think the public sees private sector unions and public sector unions differently?
Honestly, I think the public generally is fairly unaware of the intricacies of unions. You know, they either think unions are really good or completely corrupt. To be honest, it's a bit of everything. Some unions are great. Some unions are not so great. They go through phases where there's different presidents. They bring in different kind of tenures and reign, just like our political system. Yeah, I would say people don't really know, or they're not as aware. And when they think of a union, they just think it's the same across.
So, sort of speaking about the plurality that you bring up, and the unions of different people within the unions feeling different ways. How do you feel about unions? You know, we talk about collective bargaining and how powerful a tool that is. And one of the most powerful parts of that tool is when you can't come to an agreement, mm-hmm. as you've said, you strike. How do you feel about unions having to agree within their own ranks, have a majority vote on a strike? Does that hurt? Because that sort of goes against the idea of collective bargaining in a way.
I mean, that's the democratic process. And that's kind of what unions ideally try to continue and foster. Obviously, there's going to be differences with people, but the idea is you're deliberative, you're working through things, you're trying to come to a majority consensus. So there's votes, there's runoff votes. Frequently at union meetings, if a motion is, you know, tabled and discussion occurs and then voting occurs, you could be there for a couple hours that night trying to figure that issue out. Sometimes it gets forwarded to the next meeting because there is no resolution. So in a lot of ways, it's direct democracy in action. Although when people get disengaged because neglect occurs, we've seen neglect with political parties and our leaders, it's a very powerful tool. And this can obviously deter people from participating in that direct democracy that most unions encapsulate and kind of vigorously try to get people involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense that you would vote to strike within a union. I'm curious about what you mentioned as striking being a last resort. So if you have the legal right to strike, how do you have to prove that it's your last resort? And do you always have to in all cases of striking?
So you don't have to prove it's a last resort. It tends to be used as a last resort mechanism. Ideally, the union and the employer try to have somewhat amicable working relationship so they can, you know, get their interests move forward. A lot of ways it's about aligning interests, and I don't think both parties have been very successful at this, probably due to a lack of expertise and education on both sides. As complex as the government and unions can be, a lot of the time you realize one hand, one agency doesn't talk to the other, so there's serious knowledge gaps and communication gaps that occur. Mm-hmm. This all leads to, you know, heads butting and then coming to this idea of, yep, we're going to strike, even though perhaps something, maybe another meeting could have been done, maybe some more deliberation, or at least talking on the same framework to get that same idea that, hey, we're talking on completely opposite ends of the spectrum. Let's kind of meet up on a framework that we both can create and discuss our various languages.
Yeah, I mean, a strike is a big deal. It's very disruptive. You risk, you know, wasting time and, mm-hmm. Losing a lot or not gaining anything and having just, you know, lost wages. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about wages. Yeah. So when you have the legal right to strike in a government organization, that means that you receive pay?
Correct.
Okay.
There is usually a large fund, at least with the two big unions, QP and BCGU. A lot of the members' dues go to this fund, a strike fund, essentially, where if you do go on strike for the first 15 days, you're allocated a certain kind of honorarium of money per day. And if you have a family, you get more proportionally speaking. So if you do strike, you're good usually for about a half month to a month. And that's usually roughly when the strike fund runs out. But they're always trying to keep money in the coffers for the strike fund, for litigation and arbitration if necessary. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, for educational campaigns, awareness, charities, and a bunch of other activities.
Right.
So I'm curious how you think the results of BC Fair is going before the Supreme Court is going to affect precedent.
I mean, in some ways, I kind of think it comes down to the type of the lawyer, the litigation team they hire, because if they hire a good team and they pay the money, then things will be more favorable. It really does come down to how well the lawyer can kind of change the argument and show that BC Ferries is not an essential service.
Mm. Right, absolutely. I guess what I mean more by that is after the trial, depending on like what do you think the result will mean for unions in general?
I think if it's negative, and most likely they're just going to keep going at it again and again until something does change, because the precedent's already been set by the Supreme Court of Canada. So it's not like this local provincial case is going to overturn that. It'll just mean another roadblock, and then more work needs to be done. Realistically, they really need to kind of shoot this argument down and prove they aren't essential. And one way to do that might be even to coalition build with other unions and get, for instance, these larger unions involved to help them with educational campaigns and say, you know, BC Ferries is not essential as much as some people might think it is.
But who are they trying to educate?
It would be the greater public at large. It would be a public awareness
campaign. So that they support them?
Yeah, to get people on their side and say it's not essential. Of course, that might not be politically palatable because so many islanders do see it as an essential service.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how can you construct an argument to convince people that live on the island, or that people that have, you know, loved ones on the island and see it as essential, that it's not essential?
But how does public perception, support or lack of support, have any effect on whether a government issues like back to work legislation?
It'll put pressure on the NDP government. And this is a government that
through
tends
what,
to be
though, like, how friendly. How will it put pressure? Like people actually writing letters and like talking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Letter campaigns, social media, writing to your MLA, radio shows, et cetera.
So that's usually a big part of it. I mean, the biggest strikes, the most frequent strikes we see are teachers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that usually a big part of their success or failure?
It could be a big part of it. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but it could be if there's an overwhelming majority of public deciding to come out and show their support.
Mm-hmm.
With the teachers, it might have been resolved faster if people decided to protest, for instance, and there were weekly protests. That might have made a huge difference with the Campbell Clark government, and they might have actually kind of said, look, like our polls are going down, looks like we're mm-hmm. going to definitely be out next election cycle, so we need mm-hmm. to do something. And one thing we can do is get these teachers smaller classroom sizes ASAP.
Right.
So it can play into it, but it's not necessary, I would say.
I feel like a persuasive strike would be one put on by garbage picker uppers. Garbage people.
Yeah.
I think that's happened.
That would really put some irons in the fire.
That has happened a few times. When it has, you can feel the public outcry. The government feels the pressure.
Yeah.
The heat is on. And that's an example where the public has, civil society has this power to really change things drastically. And a lot of it is about next election cycle, you're out because you screwed up.
Mm.
And then politicians scramble.
You know, I think it's going to be really hard to get islanders on side with a strike, because like there's a good contingent of islanders that think BC Ferries should be free.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't even think they should pay anything. So I can't imagine that service being denied altogether would be palatable at all to them.
No, I mean, something they could do that some essential service workers do is rotating strikes. So while the service doesn't completely strike, a proportion of the service does strike. For instance, for administrative duties. So if police or other firefighters decided, no, we're going to strike, they can't strike for a call. but they can strike for, you know, showing up to work, administrative duties. But if they get a call, they need to go out. It would be roughly the same, I imagine, for forest firefighters, where we wouldn't show up to base and do regular base days and administrative duties, et cetera. But if we got a fire call, because a patch of cut block was burning, we would be compelled to go. Otherwise, we just wouldn't show up to work.
Well, yeah, I mean, what they were talking about in the article I read was that they would probably cut, like, off the white spot, you know?
Yep.
They'd still do the ferries, but there's no triple O's, so.
Damn.
Yeah, maybe,
that is effective.
Maybe they'll also be like, yeah, we're not going to clean the bathrooms until the end of the night. No maintenance workers during
right.
the day. Just the core essential service of getting the ferry from one point to the other. So
right.
That might get the public up in arms saying, you know, comply to their wishes because these ferries are just run down.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll have to see how that goes. Yeah, and with the postal workers, I'm not sure how closely. Were you following that quite closely?
No, I know they're still doing the rotating strikes because they're also deemed in some respect to be essential.
I think they're done. They voted in the House of Commons for back-to-work legislation.
So they're being pushed back.
Yeah, they're back to work. And I don't think the union is happy about it.
I doubt they would be.
The Cube W. Anyway, yeah, so we'll have to keep a lookout for what happens with the ferries. But thanks so much for chatting with us, Guy, and sharing your knowledge.
No worries.
We really appreciate it.
Yeah. So this is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We were just talking about the legalities around striking in British Columbia. And we're going to go to a short break, and then we're going to be back with some reporting on a motion that passed in City Hall on Tuesday. So stay tuned for that. Be right back.
Hey, bro, I was kind of thinking that I might want to write, like, stuff for a magazine, dude.
You know you can do that at CITR and Discorder, right?
What?
Yeah, you can review live shows where you get in for free, or music and books and stuff that's coming out, or do write-ups on artists and local issues for Discorder magazine.
That's sick, bro.
Yeah, just email volunteer at citr.ca and they can help you get started or just come into the station whenever.
Dude, I totally will.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
Hey, bro, I was kind of thinking that I might want to write, like, stuff for a magazine, dude.
You know you can do that at CITR and Discorder, right?
What?
Yeah, you can review live shows where you get in for free, or music and books and stuff that's coming out, or do write-ups on artists and local issues for Discorder magazine.
That's sick, bro.
Yeah, just email volunteer at citr.ca and they can help you get started or just come into the station whenever.
Dude, I totally will.
Not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
Let's see here. God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing.
Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Hello, and we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for listening. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Samuel Jones.
And we were just talking about the legalities of striking in BC, considering the recent postal worker strike and a case for striking that's been brought to the BC Supreme Court by BC ferry workers. Mm-hmm. So we were chatting about that. We are now going to move on to some reporting we did on City Hall on Tuesday. Sam, what were we doing at City Hall on Tuesday?
We were at City Hall covering Motion 12, which was put forward by Jean Swanson, protecting tenants from rent evictions and aggressive buyouts.
That's the title of the bill.
The VTU was organizing there, showing up. They had spoken to city council, many people facing dem evictions, and they were occupying the city hall chambers, essentially. Mm-hmm. And up in the balcony during the meeting where the passing of the motion and amendments were being made and making their voices heard.
Yeah, and they were, I mean, they were occupying it in the sense that they were there and they were, I think that activists and organizers with the VTU, the Vancouver Tenants Union, filled up the capacity of the room. There was some tension surrounding what the capacity of the room was, which you will hear about in this piece, but it was quite an energy-filled event, and the VTU's organizing was very powerful, and the motion Jean Swanson tabled passed, but it passed with some key amendments. So let's take a listen to this report. I will say to our listeners, listen in stereo if you are able to, and wear headphones, because I did some panning. So enjoy that. Okay, here we go.
You have shown that good landlords budget for repairs and pay for them out of existing rents, and you have provided copies of Regulation 23, which shows that landlords who have extra expenses can apply for extra rent increases. And you have shown that when developers threaten to stop building rental housing, that rental housing is pretty expensive anyway. And guess what? They get to set the first rents anyway.
Bring him in.
And we're just trying to keep it. One person, I let one reporter in. And I let several people in. We're just trying to keep it.
What's the number?
Let them in.
What's the number?
Vancouver City Hall, Tuesday, December 4th. As Councillor Jean Swanson carries out a press conference just outside council chambers, activists come into conflict with security. The guards are preventing folks in the hall from entering the media room and hearing Jean. But as the security guards concede to the crowd's demand, it's clear who's in charge. Jean Swanson, longtime poverty advocate, activist, and now Vancouver City Councillor, championing the rights of renters, the half of Vancouver's population who live precariously. I'm Alex DeBoer.
My name is Sarah Sagai. I'm a steering committee member with the Vancouver Tenants Union. Today, we send a signal that 2 decades of developer-controlled City Hall has come to an end.
Yes.
Gene Swanson's motion to ban rent evictions by strengthening the TRPP and calling on the province to implement vacancy control has opened the gates of the City Hall to the underrepresented members of the public.
City Hall was packed to hear debate on a motion titled Protecting Tenants from Rent Evictions and Aggressive Buyouts. Essentially, this motion demanded the city keep track of buildings when they're bought and also provide information to renters about their rights as tenants in such cases. Additionally, the motion states that landlords cannot end leases or increase rent during a period of renovation. And Section D of the motion states that the City of Vancouver should lobby the province of British Columbia to implement a form of rent control known as vacancy control.
I am a member of the working poor. My current rent is reasonable, but it already consumes 50% of my income.
Successful organizing by the Vancouver Tenants Union brought dozens and dozens of Vancouverites at risk of losing their homes out to speak to the media and make their presence known in council chambers.
As Canadians, we are supposed to have safety nets for those less fortunate. I implore our city councillors, do the right thing and build one by passing this motion tonight.
At 5 p.m., debate began over Gene Swanson's motion titled Protecting Tenants from Rent Evictions and Aggressive Buyouts. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Alex.
Hey there. So we were both at City Hall this past Tuesday reporting for CITR News. But you were inside the actual City Hall chamber where council was debating and where most media were sitting. And I was actually outside the media room where the majority of activists were sitting on the ground looking at the TV monitor on the wall to see what was happening inside because it was being live streamed.
Right. So the motion originally numbered Motion 10, but moved and revised into Motion 12, faced debate just after 5. And the first thing to happen was an amendment by Green councillor Pete Fry, which actually enhanced the motion.
Right. I remember him making that amendment. But what exactly was the amendment?
So he requested that city staff examine what more can be done to prevent dem evictions and aggressive buyouts in addition to preventing rent evictions.
Right, right. Some sort of subtle distinctions there. And I believe there was some cheering in the media room in response to that amendment. And then we moved on to another one, which was put forward by Green Councillor Adrian Carr.
Yeah, that's right. And that was a fairly benign motion. So in Clause D of the motion, which requested vacancy control, Carr simply suggested, instead of lobbying the provincial government for vacancy control in the entire province, City Hall should lobby just for Vancouver.
Right, yeah, yeah. That makes sense. Because, yeah, we don't necessarily want to determine how rent policy is established in other cities in British Columbia. But can you remind us what vacancy control is?
Yeah, absolutely. So vacancy control is when rent is tied to the unit, not the tenant. So right now, if a tenant moves out, the landlord can raise the rent as much as the market will bear. So if you lived in an affordable place, your rent might have been $600 per month, but after you leave, the next person could be forced to pay $1,000 a month.
Right, right.
With vacancy control, rent has a limit based on the unit itself, regardless of who lives there.
Right. And then after that, I believe Kennedy Stewart, now our mayor, made an important amendment, did he not?
He did indeed. So Mayor Stewart actually deferred Section D of the motion, which is what we were just talking about.
Right, yeah, the section that demands the city lobby the provincial government for the right to implement vacancy control.
Yeah, and so Stewart said that Section D ought to be deferred until further research by city staff can be conducted. He also suggested more research and legal oversight be put into Section A1 of the motion as well.
Okay, and Section A, if I recall correctly, said that the tenancy relocation and protection policy be extended to all forms of rental accommodation. And currently the policy only applies to a certain section of rental properties.
Yeah, exactly. So City Council will meet back in March to discuss A1 and D of this motion.
Right. And why do you think, I'm just curious, there was hesitation on Section A1 because Section A2 passed, which guarantees tenancy relocation and protection to most rental properties?
Yeah, there was definitely a fear, especially expressed by Councillor Adrian Carr, that if A1 passed in its current state, it could lead to secondary suites being taken off the market and reducing Vancouver's already slim vacancy rate that I believe is at like 0.80% or something.
0.9, I think. Something around there.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the vacancy rate is about 1.9% right now, so very low. And secondary suites don't fall into this category of protected rental properties. But in the end, the motion passed, did it not?
Yep. It passed with unanimous consent.
Yeah. And that's no small feat because we had the NPA voting for it. And traditionally, they have not been as supportive of policies that protect renters. So that was quite something. But it is important to note that it passed with a couple amendments, as we've been talking about. And those amendments were to Sections A1 and D. And they will be revisited in 3 months.
Right. And Mara Stewart was very clear that nothing had been taken out of the bill and that council was simply asking for more time to consider the unintended implications of these sections.
Right. And of course, like, something could be taken out in the future.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So after they revise it and they might determine we need to reword this or we need to take this out. So, I mean, it basically means more waiting and more uncertainty for renters in precarious positions.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
But considering that Cope City Councilor Jean Swanson was the one to first table this motion and to table it in a stronger form than it was passed, I wonder what her thoughts were on the version of the motion that actually passed.
Yeah, I think there was definitely some dissatisfaction on her end.
In all my 40 years of working for things, whenever you try hard to get something that's strong, it gets mushed down, and this definitely got mushed down.
What do you think it would take for things not to get mushed down? Do you appreciate the process here? Do you think it's valid that
they
made changes?
The process that I appreciate is the process of the tenants, door knocking, organizing, helping to write a motion, coming to council, lobbying, going to the media, writing articles, supporting each other, being courageous with landlords. You know, Michael Weeb said, you know, it's not right that the landlords aren't here. The landlords met behind closed doors. The landlords refused to share their letters.
Councillor Weeb.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd also like to
The moment Jean is referring to was a very memorable one, when Vancouver Green Party councillor Michael Weeb said that the number of speakers who'd come out to speak on this motion and the amount of people in the City Hall chambers showed only one side of this issue. Let's take a listen to exactly what he said.
However, the process I felt for this motion had some aspects that didn't feel like good governance. And that was one of the issues I had, and that's why I did support the referral motion, is that I felt like we were not getting proper information on such a big component to do it properly. And I think that's something that we have to look at in our process guidelines as we move forward, where amendments were being made to the motion after the speakers had ended the choice to sign up and speak here. I think that that's unfair. I think it's unfair that we didn't get voices from both sides here in the council chambers. I think that it's unfair. And I know, I think it's also
please show respect to the councillors, thank you.
And this is exactly what I'm talking about right now. And I know this isn't popular, but when you have an environment that you can't have proper democracy, where you can't have proper conversations, and you can't have proper dialogue, and that's why I really appreciate the meetings I had with everyone last night, including the BTU, because when we have dialogue to create good public board governance, this is what we need. When you have proper information,
so Councillor Weeb thought a few things about the enactment of this motion were unfair. One of them being that they didn't get to hear from both sides of the issue that day in City Hall. The voices from the landlords came in the form of mail and private meetings with councillors, rather than a presence at City Hall. Despite Councillor Weeb's claims that the process that led to this motion passing was unfair, and Councillor Swanson's own disappointment in how the amendments had watered down the renter protections she had originally sought, spirits were generally high in City Hall, and Wendy Peterson of the Vancouver Tenants Union called the motion's passing historic.
Historic. So require landlords to offer displaced tenants the opportunity to temporarily move out for the necessary duration of the renovations without their leases ending or rents increasing.
After the motion passed, we got comment from City Councilor Pete Fry.
What do you feel like this motion is saying to both renters and landlords, maybe?
Well, I think it's saying that we have a new city council, for sure, and we have a different set of priorities than the previous councils, that we are prioritizing the interests of renters over industry. I think when you look at the results, and we did meet with industry, as many of us did, including members of the MPA, and they still came around to support this. And I think what that says is that, yes, industry has concerns. A lot of them weren't really valid concerns. In fact, when we looked at the creation of new market rental, those aren't really affected by vacancy control because you can just build them and set the rents at whatever you want them to be. So vacancy control really only deals with between tenancies. So a lot of those concerns that the industry were putting forward were possibly a little exaggerated in that context. So we're sending a signal that we need to control this crisis. We need to sort of staunch the flow. And once we get our vacancy rates back up to a healthier form, we can, you know, revisit those concerns of industry about how they can make more money off the backs of tenants. But
and for what comes next, we spoke with Councillor Jean Swanson.
So what's the next step?
I'm going to go to bed. And first I'm going to try and have some supper. Then I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to take Christine home. So. And then we'll reassess the situation and definitely keep tabs on when that report comes out and make sure that it comes out on time, because a lot of times it doesn't. And, you know, go for it. And in the meantime, we got to start keep fighting for vacancy control, and the tenants will keep doing their door knocking and their going to the RTB and fighting for each other.
All right, and we are back. Hope you guys enjoyed that little piece from City Hall. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. So that piece was a little hastily rushed together at the end, but I'm going to tighten it up, and I'm going to release it on our podcast, Seeking Office, which is transitioning into the podcast at large. But I have not posted about that on social media at all, so thus it is probably confusing. but it's still in the same feed, so it's still in the Seeking Office feed. So basically it's being released under Seeking Office. That's about it. That'll be out tomorrow because I want to fix it up, as I just said. So I was there at City Hall on Tuesday, and we also had three other folks there. We had Zoe Power and Andy Laidman, and then Samuel Jones, who's here.
That's me.
Here now. Yeah, so I don't know, maybe we can debrief a little bit more on that time at City Hall. It was pretty exciting. What stood out most for you, Sam?
What stood out most for me was just like the VTU's presence.
Mm-hmm,
like
they
were just like they were just there, you know? Mm-hmm. Like they had a they were prioritizing who would be sitting up in the balcony
mm-hmm.
To watch what was going on. Like, you know, they were kind of running the show. like around City Hall. Like, yeah, security told them where to be at certain points, but that didn't last long, really.
But not even really, yeah. Like,
yeah.
It was pretty... and I think that's what Michael Wiebe, Green Party of Vancouver City Councillor Michael Wiebe was saying, as you heard in that clip. Like, mm-hmm. Basically what he was saying from, you know, listening and ruminating on it a bit, because it's a bit unclear if you just hear it for the first time, like, is he saying, like, what's unfair? People came out and spoke. Like,
yeah.
What he's saying is he finds, from my interpretation, he finds the process of a bunch of organizers and activists coming out, being loud, cheering, booing, being in City Hall, having, you know, extra speakers on the day when they allowed speakers, and having amendments tacked on last minute. He found that that was disruptive to the democratic process. That's what he said, which is really interesting because that to a lot of people is the democratic process. That's more like direct democracy, right? Having people directly stating their views and directly voicing their opinions. But I think he feels like there should be more order and that the influence of people in City Hall should not be felt on councillors, which is interesting. Because Jean Swanson, what she brings is exactly that. There's, you know, all those people are there for her. They support her. She supports them. And you can feel that support. It's powerful. There's energy there. And it's intimidating. And the counselors even commented on that. Like, Pete Fry was saying, like, I'm a little bit scared to go out there, you know, after voting in favor of some of the amendments.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I remember after council had closed the session, they decided to adjourn. One man standing up and saying, you know, 3 months of stress. Where am I going to live? Like,
mm-hmm.
And so while I do understand where these councillors are coming from, like, I, you know, it's a little hard for a person who's not in government to empathize, maybe. But, you know, they're people. And but as government officials, they do have a responsibility to hear the public. And these people have like some very legitimate concerns. And so far,
mm-hmm.
they've been nonviolent.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. I was ruminating on this a lot, I think, even while we were at City Hall, is this idea of representing your perspective to government, in this case, local government. So, for example, just in all cases where someone who doesn't have power is fighting for power, in this case we're talking about renters in Vancouver who are living in precarious situations, they the way that they express that opinion is always through being present, organizing. That's like all people have who are low income, right? Who are marginalized. Like, I mean, generally speaking, you have to use your numbers and your voices in order to be heard, whereas groups that have power and are attempting to maintain that power, in this case, landlords, the way they approach expressing their perspective is much less public, much less involving like civil disobedience or activism. It's much more behind the scenes, writing letters, which is exactly what happened. Landlords, the organization Landlord BC, wrote letters to city councillors. They had private meetings with councillors, though not Jean Swanson. They didn't even bother with her, as she told us. And so it's interesting just to like visually look at how people fight for their perspectives. And I think it's very telling to see which do it in the public, which are eager to talk to the media, which groups are excited and energetic and like willing to fight, and which are sort of fighting like but not willing to give comment, kind of more in the background.
Well, you know, Jean Swanson has a history of civil disobedience and protest. And I mean, I don't think it's at all surprising that the landlords wouldn't think to talk to her
mm-hmm.
about this. It is telling, absolutely,
mm-hmm.
And it speaks to sort of the divide that we see when people that feel the same way we do, you know, they get up and they talk about how, you know, they feel like their voices aren't being heard when the expression of the voices on the other side are simply just being heard in a different way.
Yeah, exactly.
To a different group of people. Mm-hmm. And I think the VTU just has a bigger target audience, frankly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and like what you were saying earlier about, you know, them being in control, they were absolutely in control. Like, I got there early. There were about 10 people in the what I'm calling the media room outside of city council chambers right before the press conference started. They immediately said we are on lockdown. Security said we're on lockdown. We said, what is lockdown? It sounded like there was a terrorist in the building. they said that just means we're not letting anyone else in the room. I was okay, why? There's like 10 people in this room. They were like, you know, safety. And we're like, okay, we're in the room, so I guess whatever. And then as we paid attention, they started to like selectively let certain people in. Anyway, it accumulated in that moment, which we heard at the beginning of this pre-produced piece that I just played. And essentially what happened is people were demanding to come in because the security guard had let a camera woman in. And they just kept demanding it. And we didn't get to include this interview, but we interviewed one of the VTU lead organizers. Her name's Kel. You can hear her voice saying, like, what's the capacity? Like, what's the capacity? Why aren't you letting us in? The security guard didn't say what the capacity was. We later figured out it was about 100 people based on a document that was printed on the wall for fire safety. But he didn't know. Like, he didn't say off the top of his head. And then, like, Gene Swanson starts chanting. Everyone starts chanting. They let them in. And then later they closed off the doors again for some, like, oh, there's too many people. And then the VTU members were like, okay, so we're going to organize people. We're going to get people up on the balcony. They, like, prioritized which people, which is what you were saying.
Yeah,
like, they had total control. And they essentially, like, in my opinion, were even kind of massaging the rules the guards put in place. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, well, we're going to do this. Because, to be honest, I think they understood more about what their legal rights were than the guards did.
Well, they came prepared. I mean, last episode of Seeking Office Now at Large, I mean, we talked to them about that. We talked to them about their experiences of profiling. We talked to them about their experiences of not being allowed to speak. And, you know, some members like Victor Tao of Our Homes Can't Wait feel very strongly that
Vincent Tao.
Sorry, Vincent. Vincent Tao. I apologize. Feel very strongly that that democracy is being subverted. And so I think they are really not willing to back down anymore. Like if they were before at all, not anymore. I'm not sure. But yeah, definitely they are going about this their way. And they will respect the process up until the point where it does not align with their interests.
Yeah, I mean, there a lot of the organizers have been really successful. There's really strong organizing. It's very, whether you like it or not, impressive. It's really something to see a group, the cohort in COPE, the cohort in Vancouver Tenants Union, come together and create space for a politician, get them elected. And I mean, Jean Swanson is who I'm referring to. And of course, her own reputation and experience got herself elected as well. But really, like, fight to get one person on city council on a council of 10 people. And already it seems like what Jean is doing, what Councillor Swanson is doing, is influencing the decisions council makes, the direction council's taking, more so than any other councillor. And maybe that's just because we started out with a couple motions she had tabled. But I mean, it's like the power of one person. When you have a strong backing, when you have all this energy and you have all these people who support you, the impact of it is already being seen,
yeah,
I would say. But we are a couple of minutes to the end of the show, so we wanted to acknowledge that today is the 29-year anniversary of the mass shooting at Polytechnique, which, Sam, you're going to say a few words about.
Sure, yeah. It happened today 29 years ago. Now, this massacre is the deadliest mass shooting in Canadian history and was carried out by a misogynist who believed women to be inferior to men. 20 women were shot, 14 of them died, and 4 men were shot and killed as well. The shooter primarily targeted women and left a note after turning the gun on himself, which included a list of 19 Quebec women whom Le Pen considered to be feminists, which is why he targeted them. We would like to acknowledge the anniversary of this event and show solidarity with the survivors and those whose lives have been forever changed by that day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very sad, important to remember. Misogyny and systemic sexism sucks. Yep. It's, anyway, take a moment to think about that. Yep. I'm not trying to make light of this.
Yeah.
It's just like such a pervasive,
this is something every Canadian
horrifying thing.
Think about.
Yeah. Anyway, so on that rather sad note, we will wrap up Democracy Watch. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be back again next Thursday at 5 p.m. Check your Seeking Office feeds for a new updated episode, which will be a more polished version of the report you heard on the passing of Motion 10 or Motion 12, depending on what you call it, that we played today. So tune in again next Thursday at 5. Up next on CITR 101.9 FM, we have No Dead Air. So stay tuned.
Cheers.